Well, the music that you heard before the service, that you may or may not have enjoyed, was from the American musical Hamilton. And all the members of my Bible study group have recently become quite obsessed with the music from the musical Hamilton. Hamilton tells the story of Alexander Hamilton. That's the real one on the left and the guy from the musical on the right. Alexander Hamilton is one of the founding fathers of the United States, a promoter of the US Constitution, founder of the Federalist Party, the first Secretary of the Treasury to George Washington. He fought in the Revolutionary War. He was, you know, kind of a clever guy who did a lot of things at that time. And believe me, the musical is better than it sounds. A musical about the founding fathers of the United States. Woohoo! But it's good. And it begins in 1776. Thomas Jefferson has just written the famous words of the Declaration of Independence. And one of the songs near the opening of the musical is sung by these three women, the Schuyler sisters. And they sing these words. Look around at how lucky we are to be alive right now. Look around how lucky we are to be alive right now. History is happening in Manhattan, and we just happen to be in the greatest city in the world. In the greatest city in the world. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And then she says, and when I meet Thomas Jefferson, I'm going to compel him to include women in the sequel. It's good, very clever music, good storytelling, and you'll notice that it's actually all cast with African American and Latin American performers, mostly. So it's making its own current political statement as it tells the ancient political story. But that line about Thomas Jefferson got me thinking a little bit. That at all these great moments of history and great movements for justice, great people who fought for and achieved things that are good and right, there are very often still massive blind spots and glaring omissions in the progress that's made. The equality of all men was declared in the US Declaration of Independence in 1776, but of course it took another 150 years until women were allowed to vote. And until women were granted equal rights in the American Constitution. We can tell the same or similar story in our own country and our treatment of our Indigenous peoples. Often, while elevating some declarations of the rights and the liberties of some, we somehow manage to find ways to exclude others. You can think, perhaps, of some other contemporary examples. In the last few months, even, the world has been puzzled by Aung San Suu Kyi. She fought for democracy in her country. She won a Nobel Peace Prize. She was imprisoned, suffered for her cause. But she hasn't quite followed the script that we expected of her, has she? It's a year since she came to power in Myanmar, and many people are puzzled by what seems like her silence on what people are calling human rights abuse, crimes against humanity, possibly a genocide of the Rohingya Muslims in that country. We all thought she was a great champion of human rights, and now we say, well, whose rights does that extend to? World War I was supposedly the war to end all wars. It's true that these days we don't have quite so many international conflicts, but in 2017 there are just as many people as were killed in the whole of World War II, which is something like 60 million, who are currently refugees or displaced persons around the world. 60 million today. In 2008, Barack Obama stood in Berlin near the Brandenburg Gate, at the site of where the Berlin Wall had been, some 20 years after it had come down, and made a speech to the crowd and said this: "This is the moment to secure the peace of the world without nuclear weapons. This is the moment we must come together to save the planet. The walls between races and tribes, natives and immigrants, Christian and Muslim and Jew cannot stand. These now are the walls that must come down." It's nearly 10 years since that speech, and we might ask ourselves what's happened in Germany since then, what's happened in Britain, what's happened in the US, what's happened in the Middle East, and here we are once again with North Korea threatening nuclear attacks. Now, you didn't come to church to feel depressed, I'm sorry. He says you often hear people, pardon me, use the phrase, the right side of history. Don't know if you've heard that phrase in our political discourse, the right side of history. And in some quarters, it seems like to be on the wrong side of history is just about the worst thing you can possibly do. Now, whatever you might think about how that phrase is applied to particular causes in our world, and I'm not saying anything about any one of those, but as an argument itself, I think it's pretty weak. Does history have a conscience? Does history have a moral imagination or an ethical framework? Does history have an intentional goal that's slowly but inevitably working towards? The right side of history, if anything, suggests that, well, something now seems inevitable, so you might as well get on board. But just because something is inevitable, does it make it right? And in fact, are the things that we all think are now inevitable, are they truly inevitable? The right side of history is all well and good if you like where things are going. But there are parts of our world in which modern history, recent history, has brought nothing but deep, deep suffering and horror and bloodshed. So if the right side of history means the inevitable, or really just means the winning side, then I think we're in trouble. Is optimism about history well-founded? That's really the question. Do you believe that the march of time is always a march in the right direction, or that it will be eventually? That's kind of the Enlightenment view from the 18th century that we all grew up influenced by, a time of optimism. Technology, progress, democracy can sort things out. In 1989, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Francis Fukuyama, you might have heard of what he wrote about the end of history, praising the arrival of what he thought was the best form of social organisation, that's liberal democracy with free market economics. He said that this form of social organisation, because it gives people choice, freedom, rights, participation, and a recognition of each person's own dignity, he said this would leave people completely satisfied. Completely satisfied. This was the dawn of utopia. But history itself doesn't have a conscience, it doesn't have a goal, and it's not destined for utopia. History is just the story of the actions of humans. So if we want to know whether history is marching towards utopia, the question we have to ask, I think, is not whether history is getting better, it's whether humans are getting better. Are human hearts any better? More civilised, less selfish? And what's all any of this got to do with the Book of Daniel? Daniel was written to encourage God's people, the people of Israel, who at the time that it was written in the 6th century BC were living under foreign rule and were suffering persecution. If you remember back a few months to as we looked at the first 6 chapters of the book, Israel had been conquered by the Babylonians. Daniel and his friends, they're the kind of best and brightest of Israel, were taken off into exile to live in the Babylonian court for what we might now call cultural eradication. Their nation, their culture, and their religion were all under threat. And that's all that defined them as a nation. The nation, their land, everything about them and their identity as God's people was being destroyed. And we saw in this first half of the book that God protected Daniel and his friends. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, you remember these stories of the lion's den and the fiery furnace? Examples of faithfulness in difficult circumstances, but more importantly, the stories are demonstrations of God's power and God's protection of his people under threat. And in the first 6 chapters, we have this storytelling, this narrative about Daniel and his friends in their day. And then the second half of the book, as we start today in chapter 7, we move into this other genre of biblical literature called apocalyptic. Apocalyptic books, Daniel and Revelation is another of them, kind of speak about our future, the turbulent end times, and shift into this series of visions or dreams that Daniel has and then somewhat interprets. Apocalyptic is kind of about the end times, but it actually just means revelation. That's why the book Revelation is called Revelation. It's an apocalypse. So apocalyptic literature is meant to reveal something that we can't otherwise see. What's going on under the surface, so to speak, or behind the curtain? It gives the divine eternal perspective, a broader view, a bigger sweep that underlies human history. And so we zoom out from these particular stories about faithful people and God's protection to the big picture of human history. This vision in chapter 7, God kind of says to Daniel, things seem pretty bleak now, perhaps for you and your friends, but you know what? They might actually get even worse. Feels like that's part of the point of the picture. 4 beasts coming up out of the stormy, turbulent waters. A lion with eagle's wings, a bear devouring flesh and bone, a leopard with 4 heads and 4 wings. They're meant to be these distorted images of creation. And this final terrifying, frightening beast with large iron teeth and 10 horns who destroys everything. Verse 17 tells us that the beasts represent 4 kings or 4 kingdoms who will rise up on the earth. That part's kind of fairly straightforward, and it's in there in the passage. Most commentators see in these beasts some kind of combination of the Babylonian, the Median, the Persian, the Greek, and the Roman empires. Got to fit those 5 somehow into the 4, or leave one out. That's kind of the debate is around those. At the immediate historical level, beginning with the Babylonians and the day in which Daniel lives. But also, at another level, it's just an image of a succession of worldly powers until the end of time. One after another of beastly rule. That's the picture. People love to get carried away with identifying the beast and drawing them and saying what they mean and who's the little horn and when will he come and all of those questions. But the more important part of the vision is actually the second half. It's not the beasts. It's the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. Because these are the 2 that have the victory in the end. The beasts ultimately are destroyed. The Ancient of Days is seated on the throne. Verse 13, coming on the clouds of heaven, there's one like a son of man. One like a son of man probably just actually means one like a human. So he's a human and not a beast. The one coming to rule from heaven, as opposed to those who come out from the earth, is actually more human than those who arise on earth. And this part of the vision we commonly now understand to refer to Jesus. I'm going to take these pictures off because they're not actually very helpful for us, but people love to draw them. And we see in the Gospels, the New Testament, that the writers refer to Jesus as the Son of Man, as we heard from Matthew 26. So this is a vision of the end of history. The coming of the Son of Man, who approaches the Ancient of Days, is led into his presence and he's given authority, glory and power. All nations, all peoples of every language worship him, and it's an everlasting kingdom. All the beasts lose all their power, and it's God's appointed person, the Son of Man, who has eternal authority. So you might say, actually, that in one sense the biblical story agrees with the kind of Enlightenment story about the future, that history does have a goal and a good future. But it disagrees with that story, I think, because it says we don't actually get there through human progress or human achievement. The picture of human history is mistake after failure after mistake after failure, beast after beast after beast, and the future comes only by God's intervention. That's the vision. God must do what no earthly powers can do. And there's a stark contrast between the other kings and the kingship of Jesus, the Son of Man. They're beasts, they're terrifying animals, they're distorted creation, and they rule in a beastly way, in a way that frightens and terrifies and preys on people. But God's king is fully human, truly human, and he leads people into the fullness of humanity. The beasts destroy, but the Son of Man is worshipped. The beasts are destroyed, but the Son of Man rules forever. The beasts are judged, condemned, but the Son of Man is given authority. And the beasts arise from this chaos, watery chaos, which symbolises in the Old Testament horror, danger and evil. Chaos of creation. Son of Man instead comes from heaven. Now, the point of this vision for Daniel is not to be clever about predicting the future, but it's to demonstrate for him and his people the relationship between the earthly kingdoms and God's power. And it's to reassure them, though they live under persecution and suffering and their identity feels like it's entirely unravelled, it's to reassure them that though the human evil and chaos and destruction thrives, that they don't know what will happen to them, that God is still in control and that he will have the victory. That's the point of the vision for Daniel and for the Israelites. But what does it mean for us today? We're not in the same position as Daniel. Despite what some people might say, I don't really believe that Christians in Australia are persecuted or suffering. We don't know exactly what it's like to have an evil regime direct its power and oppression against us. Though some of you who've perhaps lived in other parts of the world or are connected to them may have some of that experience. Nevertheless, many of us perhaps do feel that sense of despair about the state of the world. Perhaps not for our own future, but for others. We can see the terror and chaos of any number of rulers in any number of places at any one time. And perhaps you are asking, is God really in control? But at the same time, we're probably inclined to be optimistic as well about human progress. We expect our government to be better. We expect Aung San Suu Kyi to be better. We expect the United Nations to do something. We think that if we can just export liberal democracies with free market economics, then things might turn out okay. The people of Daniel's time looked forward to God's appointed ruler who would rule forever in peace. They needed that vision of the judgment of evil and the victory of God. Of course, they didn't know then what we know now about Jesus, which is that before he comes to judge and to rule at the end of time, he comes as a human to die. The New Testament writers take up this picture of Jesus as the Son of Man coming on the clouds in heaven, and we heard that from Matthew 26. But they also use this phrase, the Son of Man, which is a recollection of Daniel 7 and all that it says about Jesus. They also use that phrase when they speak about Jesus and his coming death. In Mark chapter 9, Jesus says, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. And Matthew 20 says, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So before the Son of Man enters the throne room to rule, in that vision of the end of history when all things are restored, he first comes to give his life. He is not a king like those other kings who take power and trample on others. And he shows us that our problem is not just out there with our broken systems and our governments and the chaos in the world who just can't get it together, but actually the problem for government, the problem for the world, the problem for us is the problem of every human heart. And that's the problem of sin. And that's what Jesus comes first to deal with. Tom Wright writes, it's always tricky to say that, Tom Wright writes, the line between good and evil does not lie between us and them, between the West and the rest, between left and right, between rich and poor. That fateful line runs down the middle of each of us. Every human society, every individual. This is not to say that all humans and all societies are equally good or bad, far from it. Merely that we are all infected and that all easy attempts to see the problem in terms of us and them are fatally flawed. This is a problem that no government is powerful to solve. It's also why all earthly kingdoms, no matter how good, comparatively, are beastly to some degree, are broken to some degree. It's also why we need a king who comes from somewhere else, who is not tainted by that same problem. So perhaps for us the challenge is kind of the opposite of what it was for the Israelites in the 6th century. They needed reassurance that they could hope in God's future. But Daniel 7 reminds us, perhaps, that no matter how good or bad we have it, our kingdom is not of this world. We must be realistic about the bad that bad governments can do. We must also be sober about the good that good governments can do. Liberal democracy and free market economics cannot save us. Not that I'm opposed to those things. The Israelites needed to be reminded that they could have hopeful confidence in the victory of God in the end. Perhaps we need to be reminded that our hopeful confidence must be in the victory of God. Not just in the end, but over sin now. We can be confident in what God has done in Jesus, and we can be confident in what the future brings from God through Jesus. So Daniel 7 reminds us that no matter how good or bad, our kingdom is not of this world.